welcome to the House of Comments. This is a fortnightly podcast where we talk about politics and political issues. I'm Mark Thompson, and I'm delighted to be joined by Nick Dennis. How are you doing, Nick?
Very good, Mark. How are you?
Good, thank you. Emma's not with us tonight. She's busy doing, you know, ever since she got her master's in journalism, she's all off la-di-da, you know, schmoozing and doing all that sort of stuff and, you know, doing important things. And, you know, she's just leaving us to get on with it now.
So. Well, it's very kind that she's let us amateurs, you know, host the show for a week.
I haven't got any qualifications for this at all.
No, not at all, Mark. Not at all.
Yeah, so God knows what we'll get up to. Right, so the first thing that we thought we'd talk about is there was a survey recently published. Was it The Guardian that commissioned it? I saw it was in The Guardian.
The Guardian didn't commission the work. The stats come from YouGov, and I think it's a Cambridge University project, but The Guardian had a sort of comment piece about it.
Okay. And what it is basically lots of people in this country believe in conspiracy theories far more than I'm comfortable with, frankly. Wasn't it something like nearly half or slightly more than half?
Yeah, 60% apparently. Crazy. Apparently 60% believe in conspiracy theories. But Mark, just because it's a conspiracy theory doesn't mean there's not a conspiracy.
Depends what conspiracy theories you're talking about, though, because, like, you know, did Trump collude with Russia to rig the US election? I doubt he colluded in the sense that some people think, but he's very cavalier with things and he may well have said and done things he probably shouldn't have done. Whether it comes down to collusion, I don't know. And that's the one that sometimes people cite and say, oh, well, you know, if you believe in that, that's just a conspiracy theory. You know, I think quite often you've got to think about Occam's razor here, you know, the idea that what's the most plausible explanation. And the problem that I have with most conspiracy theories is they just throw that sort of thinking completely out the window. And in order to believe the conspiracy theory, you have to just believe that, you know, a massively complicated series of things have taken place that just there's a far simpler explanation.
I mean, I agree, Mark. And I put you and me in this as well, but I've never come across human beings who are intelligent enough to make a conspiracy theory last.
Well, think about, say, something like Watergate. I mean, that brought a president of the United States there. And Watergate was a bunch of men, only a handful of men. There weren't that many people involved in the conspiracy. A hotel was broken into and, you know, things were stolen and, you know, things were rifled through. And they couldn't keep a lid on that. And there were only a handful of people. So when you start comparing it to things like we didn't land on the moon, or 9/11 was an inside job by the Bush administration, or Princess Diana was murdered by Prince Philip and his acolytes. I mean, those things just don't stand up to scrutiny because, like, the number of people it would have taken to be involved and never breathe a word.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there is, and what seems to be in vogue at the moment, actually, is just doing things out in the open up front and then flooding the world with lots of information. I mean, obviously, the Saudis with killing that columnist recently and, you know, the Russians basically murdering people on British soil in a very traceable way. The opposite seems to happen with the over sort of burden of information. People are just doing things out in the open, then chucking lots of extra information in there to confuse and obfuscate. And so, I mean, the main thing so that these academics asked, I think, put five or six different scenarios to people, say, do you or do you not believe them? And the one that came top with 44% believing this was, in quotation marks, even though we live in what is called a democracy, a few people will always run things in this country anyway. So that was like their top conspiracy theory.
Yeah, you see, that's a borderline one, though. I read about that one. I mean, I'm not sure I would necessarily subscribe to the precise wording of that, but there's definitely a kernel of truth in that it is usually the same sorts of people that end up rising to the top. You know, why do we usually end up with politicians who are privately, you know, why are there so many more privately educated MPs and peers than is the case in the average population? And it's because things are structurally set up for those people to succeed in those sorts of professions more. So I'm not sure. That's a tendentious one, isn't it, really?
It is. I mean, the ones that are, it won't surprise you to know that, and to use wording that's actually even more towards the sort of crazy end of conspiracy theories, they did also ask, do a secret group of powerful people who really control world events like wars and economic crisis exist? And apparently 43% of Labour supporters and 46% of UKIP supporters said yes.
That's more down the batshit end, isn't it? Because that's basically lizards and or George Soros are running everything.
Indeed. But obviously, you know, that's almost half a Labour. People who said they supported Labour within the survey said this, 43%, so it's not just half. Mm-hmm. But obviously the Conservatives come up worse on the or Conservative people come up worse on stuff like the UK government is hiding the truth about the number of immigrants living here, and the EU officials are seeking to take over all lawmaking powers in the UK, which was definitely true about 50% for both of those. Wow. These are disturbing numbers. But you know, I mean, why do we think this happening? I mean, one thing is with all the information that's out there, you know, what do you believe? And if you don't know what to believe, do you just go back to your hunches?
Well, but that's why we had the Enlightenment. That's why we have the scientific method. That's why we have, you know, reason and rationality. And, you know, I just referred to it earlier on, Occam's razor, you know, kind of rational thinking and the ability to actually, you know, critical thinking, being able to put together a plausible sequence of events, you know.
Yeah.
How would the police ever solve any crimes if they took this approach? If they just said, well, I think that person was murdered because, you know, because someone swung in from a chandelier. Do you know what I mean? It's like you could imagine all kinds of cockamamie theories that people would have about stuff. But actually, if you're going to solve stuff, if you're going to make scientific breakthroughs, if you're going to invent new products that are world changing, you've got to actually put the hard graft in and do the proper work for this stuff and understand how the world actually works, not how you think it works, or, you know, some crazy theory.
Well, one of my theories is that you know, I've been involved in the political world for a long time, and I know you have as well, Mark. And I remember in the early 2000s, I think it was it the early 2000s, or was it even the mid to late to, you know, around about 2010-ish, there was a lot of talk about evidence-based policy making. Mm-hmm. And this especially came from the sort of New Labour sorts, and from the left, and from the New Labour sorts especially. And it was almost like there were, you know, they were using proof and clever arguments and statistics to tell people what was real rather than what people thought was real. And immigration was obviously, I think, the number one on that. And, you know, people were saying, you know, immigration is a problem. And then the sort of evidence-based policy lot would come back and say, but we've got the evidence that says actually immigrants make life better and you know, all this sort of stuff. And I think through that sort of way of arguing about things, plus obviously the 2008 crash, where essentially we let, as a society and politicians certainly, let very, very clever finance people and economists get on doing stuff, and suddenly we realized that actually they didn't really know what they're doing, and they crashed the whole system, and they weren't that clever, except obviously they still seem to be doing quite well. Austerity hasn't seemed to touch them as it has other people, and I think you put all those things, those two things together, then I think that creates, along with the information overload that we have, and also with the internet, where, you know, you can easily find groups of people who agree with you to reinforce you. Like in the olden days, if you believe that the moon landing didn't happen, you know, the chances of you meeting somebody else who also believed that were very slim. Maybe once a month you might go to your local "I don't believe the moon landing happened" group, but otherwise you'd have to talk to people in the pub about it.
It's even worse than that, though, isn't it? Because the way you've described it almost makes it sound like the things happened in isolation, and there might have been, you know, pockets of people all around the world who didn't believe that the moon landing was real, just kind of individuals all kind of coming to that conclusion themselves. But actually what happens is people go onto forums and they start saying, well, you know, why weren't the flags fluttering, and why were the shadows at this angle? And, you know, and they start, I'm just asking questions. And, like, you know, these questions have been, the answer to these questions have been given many, many, many times. Ben Goldacre refers to these as zombie arguments, where answers are given, and they're given in good faith, and this is the reason, and then they just go, yeah, but what about such and such? And then they'll go around a big circle, and 20 minutes later they'll be back to the same questions about the flags again, even though that's already been answered. But the thing with the internet is it allows, like you say, people to cluster together and G each other up. And so people who maybe wouldn't have come to the conclusion that the moon landings were fake spend a few weeks or a few months or a few years on a forum,
yeah,
and they believe it then. And it never would have really occurred to them that the moon landings were fake. And so I reckon, I think I used to have this posted pinned to the top of my Twitter feed. I don't think I have anymore, but it was a comment I made along the lines of, we now have access to basically all the information that humanity has ever had at the touch of a button. And yet so many people use the internet to keep themselves ignorant. And I don't, I genuinely lament the fact that, you know, when I was a kid, I just, you know, I would so have loved to have had something like the internet and be able to just find out anything. And I was like 10, 12, 14, you know, just be able to click and find, but actually there's so much bullshit out there.
It is
hard to wade through it all. I get that. I mean, in a way, I'm probably lucky that the internet didn't really exist when I was a kid, because I could easily have gone down one of these rabbit holes, I suppose, if I wasn't careful.
Yeah, but it all depends on the individual themselves, Mark, of course. And you know, you're a rational type of guy. You know, you were a Lib Dem, you're really into electoral reform. you're very, you know, you even talk about the Enlightenment. So you know, and I'm a sort of very curious and rational person as well, and so I, you know, I use the internet with all the information that's out there to sort of look at things, investigate things, come to my own opinion, speak to people, all this sort of stuff, and I find that really satisfying and the most amazing, you know, I think I have the most amazing life because I have all this information here to think about things and learn how to do things better. But many people aren't really, either they're not overly interested, so they don't, you know, they don't geek out as much as we do, or you know, that they don't want to believe stuff, and then they're happy to go down routes which take them to reconfirm what they're saying. But I think one thing that's quite interesting is, and I'm looking, so the article in The Guardian was titled "Britons Are Swallowing Conspiracy Theories, Here's How to Stop the Rot." And interestingly, underneath in the little subheading they have before the article, it says aliens exist and global warming is a hoax. These unbelievable beliefs are symptoms of people feeling threatened. And what I find really interesting is obviously The Guardian's picked two things which Guardian readers would be shocked and horrified about, people making conspiracy theories about. And I think it's all, you know, across the internet, people are just grouping together. And even if it's not a conspiracy theory or a lie or fake news, polarization happens in almost, you know, all over the internet, you know, including on The Guardian, which, you know, I have a lot of time for The Guardian as well.
It's true. People end up in silos, don't they? And one of the things that I found quite depressing about what we've seen happen recently is I read a book few years ago now called Voodoo Histories by David Aronovich. I think I've mentioned that on this podcast before, and it's all about conspiracy theories. It's about the history of conspiracy theories, how, you know, where it all started, how they propagate, why people might want to believe them, etc. And it kind of does it through the medium of a series of different conspiracy theories. Kind of each chapter focuses on a different conspiracy theory. And the first one, in the first chapter, is the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was a document that circulated in the 19th century.
It sounds like a really awesome 1970s heavy metal band.
probably is. Probably the Protocols of the Elders of something. But no, it was a conspiracy. It was a document that was a conspiracy theory that basically said that the Jews run everything in the world, or there's a conspiracy for the Jews to try and take over everything in the world. And what's really depressing is that that is still happening now.
Oh yeah.
You know, people like Donald Trump. You know, there are people all over the world who still believe that and who propagate that stuff. You know, it was one of the things that helped Hitler justify what he did in Germany. That document, because millions of German citizens believed that conspiracy theory because of the circulation of that document and variations of it. And, you know, that's how pernicious these things can be. That's how dangerous these things can be. Once you start to believe things like that, things become possible. Terrible things become possible. Because if you believe that there's a secret conspiracy to take over the world, well, what are you going to do to protect yourself against the people who are trying to take over the world?
I mean, my biggest hate in our modern society is you know, the dehumanization or the sub, you know, treating people as subhuman that happens, you know, on a regular basis now. And, you know, in a very simple way on Twitter, people set up accounts with, you know, ugly pictures and fake names. And then they feel like they can treat anybody in any sort of way, and especially women. I mean, I occasionally get some abuse, but I get nothing compared to women who are on Twitter. And, you know, these are people who obviously are cowards because they don't have their real name. They have these, you know, stupid pictures which aren't themselves, so they know what they're doing is basically not acceptable. But you know, that's a small version of the bigger version of what's happening as well, which is essentially talking about people as if they're not as human or subhuman, very, you know, obviously immigration and, you know, Donald Trump did it very much with the caravan of immigrants who were heading their way towards the USA, or still are heading their way towards the USA as well. You know, and Donald Trump does it for political ends, but, you know, you're fanning hate. And, you know, I'd hate to be, you know, a Mexican person in the US at the moment, when you've got the President of the United States basically, you know, talking about people, you know, in the same ethnicity as you, as being almost like subhuman in order to whip up people.
Yeah,
it's dreadful. You know, it's absolutely the worst thing. And the internet, unfortunately, the way it's designed, the way it operates, is all about emotion. This is the problem. It's easy to hit people's emotions, and yeah.
And that old saying of, you know, the lies halfway around the world before the truth's even got its boots on. I mean, that was true even in the analog age. Now in the digital age, I mean, I've seen studies on this, that the fake news variation of stories goes all around the world immediately, and the rebuttal is really struggling to keep up and won't be seen by anything like as many people that have seen the original lie.
Yeah.
You see this time and time again, and I, you know, hands up, I have been guilty of it occasionally. Occasionally I see some meme or something that pops up on Twitter that chimes with my own prejudices, and I think, yeah, I bet that's true, and then I retweet it, and then half an hour later I find out it's a load of bollocks. That I've done that a few times. Try not to nowadays, actually.
Yeah.
When I see something that seems too good to be true because it really chimes with my own prejudices, I actually spend 30 seconds or a minute just Googling it and trying to find out, is there a Snopes article on it? Is there some way I can verify this first before I retweet it? And if I can't, I don't retweet it anymore. Or at least someone will probably find something that I did 3 weeks ago where I didn't adhere to that, but I really try to, because I don't want to be part of this bullshit propagation machine that the internet has become, and that social media in particular has become. You know, I really want to only share things that are true or are very, very likely to be true. Sometimes you can't be totally sure about something. You know, I can't spend ages and ages researching stuff, but usually you can find out pretty quickly if something is nonsense or if something seems like it's nonsense.
If it hits that primeval, you know, button inside you, and you sort of, you know, pump the air of like, yes, this proves exactly why I want to be true, then you know, it's worth looking a bit more deeply into it to make sure it does.
First past the post gives you cancer. That's definitely true. I'm going to share that one. In fact, there's a new meme straight after this recording. I'm going to start circulating that one, because it's almost certainly true, isn't it, Nick?
Oh, I think so, because it fits in with what you believe, and you're a very reasonable, nice guy, and everybody you speak to says the same.
Exactly. Actually, almost everyone I speak to couldn't give a flying toss about electoral reform. But anyway, I mean, the other thing that we were going to talk about today is sort of linked to what we just talked about in a way. And it's the way that the whole Brexit debate has changed. Now, the reason I wanted to talk about this, I saw a very long thread on Twitter, but it chimed with my own personal prejudices, so it must be true. there's a segue for you.
Yes, indeed.
No, it was talking about how the idea that we would leave the EU with no deal was not seriously discussed at all before the referendum. And it just wasn't. I mean, I remember that referendum debate. The idea that we weren't going to get a deal was just pilloried by the Leave side. Some on the Remain side were saying that, you know, you've got to be careful, because if we don't leave, then we could end up, you know, crashing out, and there would be terrible economic damage and da-da-da-da-da. But the Leave side...
Was it Liam Fox who said it'd be the easiest trade deal in history or something?
I mean,
there's a
massive list. Someone, I think it was Alex Andreu from the Romaniacs podcast, did a huge screed of things that various people on the Leave side had said in the run-up to the referendum. And that was one of them. But there were loads of them. Easiest deal ever. And they'll be begging us for a deal, and they'll be knocking down our door, and the day after the referendum German car makers will insist that Merkel does a deal with us, and blah 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 blah. Right, so the idea that we were going to leave with no deal was absolutely traduced by the Leave side, and that was actually true for quite a while after the referendum result as well, in the early days before Article 50 had been triggered and before the negotiations had started. The idea we were going to leave with no deal again was just was considered nonsense by the Leave side. And probably most Remain people didn't think that we were going to leave with no deal either. So the vast majority of the population didn't think we were going to leave with no deal. And frankly, if before the referendum, what the Leave side had been saying is, we're going to leave with no deal, we're not going to have any agreements with any of the EU countries, and all of these arrangements we've currently got will just go off a cliff, and we won't have any arrangements, and we will just have to cope with things. And, you know, there may well be economic consequences, but it will all be worth it because we'll get our sovereignty back. If they'd have said that, they wouldn't have won the referendum. There's no way they would have done, because the feeling at that point was people were quite nervous about this. And even though it ended up being 52%, that was with Leave saying it would be amazing, it would be fantastic, sunlit uplands, best deal ever, blah, blah, blah. 2.5 years on, we're in a position where surveys are showing that, depending on exactly how you phrase the question, a majority of people would rather leave the EU with no deal than remain. And that is a textbook example of goalpost shifting, where the way this debate has gone in this country over the last 2.5 years, it's become very polarised. And what people on the Leave side have done is pivot from best deal ever to, well, it won't be as bad as the Remain side are saying, to, well, at least we'll still have our sovereignty, to, but this is what everyone voted for, so we've got to get on with it. It's the people's will. And so what they've done is they've taken what they consider to be a mandate from the referendum result, and they have slowly, like a frog boiling in a pan, they've slowly turned the temperature up more towards harder and harder Brexit and eventually no deal. And the thing that seems crazy to me is that lots of people who voted, you can tell from the polling at the time and before the referendum, that the vast majority of people wouldn't have been up for a no deal. But loads of people who now voted Leave actually think they voted for no deal. They've been convinced by the way this debate has gone that that is what they voted for, when it isn't what they voted for. They voted for the best deal ever. They voted for sunlit uplands. They voted for German car makers and French cheese makers and Italian and Spanish wine makers to be lobbying their governments to insist that we get the best deal you could ever possibly imagine. So I don't really see how this can be justified. And yet that is where we are.
Where do we start with Brexit, Mark?
Well, it's like a fascinating sociological experiment in basically gaslighting millions of people and taking them along with your bullshit down a road while you shift the Overton window very slowly. And again, I now start to sound like a conspiracy theorist, and I'm not a conspiracy theorist when it comes to this.
Conspiracy theorists are conspiracy theorists when they come to their own conspiracy theory, Mark.
Well, the way this has happened is slowly but surely. There's been no kind of grand plan behind it. It's just the way things have gone, because the original plans and the original ideas of best deal ever was obviously a load of bollocks. All the people who said that have been forced by political circumstance to start to shift their story. And they've all kind of done it in a similar way, because how else are you going to do it? What are they going to say? We got it wrong. We lied to you. We've actually put ourselves in a very, very, we've put ourselves in a lot of jeopardy here, and we're really risking the economy going off a cliff. No, they're not going to say that. And so what they're doing is they're starting to try and rewrite history. But, you know, tens of millions of people in this country are letting them get away with it. I'm not, and people like us aren't. People like us can see what's going on. I just don't understand how so many millions of people are going along with this.
I feel quite conflicted about all of this, because I suppose I never really believed the sort of no deal is not a risk, and you know, they'll make a deal with us and German car manufacturers. And I think in a funny way, Remain, with their Project Fear, as it was called, I think they did make the case for, you know, off the edge of a cliff, and this could be an economic disaster. And the Leavers were sort of were saying, actually, no, we are going to make a deal. So I actually think the argument was made during the campaign, and I certainly, you know, did think it was a possibility and a risk, certainly, that I didn't think was worth taking. I don't think people would, you know, they looked into it that granularly. I think people don't really understand what no deal or really involves, or what no deal really means. I mean, obviously the true no deal means, you know, obviously medicines stop coming, you know, planes can't fly, all this sort of stuff. And I'm pretty sure, you know, that really, really extreme version of no deal will be avoided. I mean, it's not, obviously, because I think it's impossible doesn't mean it will be impossible, but I find it absolutely impossible and inconceivable that there won't be at least a 2-year transition a period, even if it's towards no deal. I think absolutely suits no one at all, not the EU, not us, not anyone, to have not a transition period from whatever is agreed or not agreed to the end point. There is a group of Brexiteers, and they're actually a lot smaller group than the noise that they make suggests that they are, and that's been shown by their inability to raise 48 letters to get a vote of no confidence in Theresa May, who I sometimes feel are almost acting like a policy Ponzi scheme, really, and doubling down. And they're almost on this road where they can't come back. And, you know, I think Boris Johnson, for me, was obviously somebody who was leading the Leave campaign. His face after Leave won, I mean, it really did say to me, his face and demeanor was, what the hell has happened? This wasn't meant to happen. What are we going
to
do?
Yeah, he wanted to lose narrowly, so he would be seen as a champion, but wouldn't actually have to do anything, and then he could become prime minister.
And then for a couple of weeks, he was just all over the place, and you know, because he couldn't cope. And I think then he basically decided, well, I've got to own this thing, and started doubling down. And others, sort of, you know, who've always believed in the purity of Brexit, have started doubling down behind him as well. But you know, I think this is an absolute massive mess. But, you know, there is not a parliamentary majority at all for no deal at all. Now, you know, the argument against that could be, well, no deal can be forced on us because of the triggering of Article 50. Well, I think in theory, of course, that's correct. But I don't think the EU are interested in no deal either. And I think if Parliament voted to extend Article 50 or you know, or whatever, I think the EU would accept that. And I think Parliament would, you know, as a backstop, you'd use that new phrase that's come into our language. I think that won't happen. Now, that's not directly talking about your point, is in terms of why more and more people, when they're polled, saying they're okay with no deal. And I think that's basically because they haven't engaged with the substance of the subject. And, you know, when you listen to all the politicians arguing with each other, why would you engage in the substance of the subject? Because, you know, I mean, I've made this point a number of times, that the referendum was, you know, obviously a new way of doing politics, and basically said something fundamentally important about what people want in life, more than just Brexit, which is they want more control over their lives. With the NHS bus stuff, they want more investment in public services they care about. But as soon as the referendum was over, Westminster politics, the Conservative Party, even the Labour Party, have just gone back to traditional old school politics and sort of forgotten about all that other stuff. I think people just sort of, there is a big bunch of people who are fed up and, you know, just get on with it, whatever it is.
Yeah, I just find it. I mean, I suppose the problem is I pay a lot of attention to this stuff, and I always have done ever since I was a kid, really. I've always listened to what politicians say. I've listened to political speeches. I've read articles. I've read biographies. You know, I always try and deeply understand what's going on. And so, you know, when the idea that we might leave the EU was being mooted, my view was, I don't think that would be a good thing. I think we're better off in. I have no massive love for the EU. I'm sure I've said this on this podcast before. And I didn't get out there on the streets and campaign for it. I talked to a few people about it, and then I went and voted the way I wanted. And I was surprised. I was very surprised when it ended up being leave. And I suppose I did assume that, you know, there would be some sort of plan, but it's clear that there isn't a plan. And also, like, the political tail has wagged the economic dog all throughout this process. So the mere fact that Article 50 was triggered when it was triggered in the way it was triggered was a political necessity rather than anything to do with economics or strategy, negotiating tactics or anything like that. It was purely because there were loads of people who thought that it wouldn't be triggered ever, and that we were never going to leave the EU. And therefore, in order to demonstrate that we were going to leave the EU, and especially because Theresa May campaigned for Remain, ironically, if we'd have had a Leaver as Prime Minister after Cameron resigned, they might have had some more political wiggle room to be able to say, look, we need to do this the right way. We need to take our time. Right. But because May wasn't trusted by loads of her own backbenchers, let alone people around the country who voted Leave, she felt compelled to trigger Article 50 much earlier than is probably in our country's interests.
And let's not forget that almost every single political party, you know, supported the triggering of Article 50. And I thought it wasn't just a Conservative thing. It was basically, I mean, Lib Dems didn't, a couple of Lib Dem MPs did, but most of the vast majority of the political parties all said, yes, let's trigger Article 50.
I know. And it was like
a jolly jape, wasn't it? Let's jump off the edge of a cliff without knowing what's below. We can see some sea, but we don't know how far down it is.
It's like the Emperor's New Clothes. It's like, you know, Everyone in Parliament, or almost everyone in Parliament, was something like 500 odd MPs voted for it, and about 30 voted against or something.
Yes, yes.
It's like the Emperor's New Clothes, where it's like, you know, they're all saying, oh, yeah, yeah, Article 50, it's going to be brilliant if we trigger that. Now, there are so many people who are saying, oh, it was a mistake to trigger Article 50 when we did, because we haven't given ourselves enough time, and that's why we've got to have these extension periods and da-da-da-da-da. And it's like, well, hang on a minute. Like, you know, 95% of MPs who voted in favour of triggering Article 50. Any fool could see that triggering it in that way, so giving yourself a 2-year countdown in order to try and negotiate all the stuff. You know, it's taken us 40 years to get this deeply embedded. And actually, I saw Mark Wallace, and I've seen other people as well make reference to this. Mark Wallace from Conservative Owners, been a former guest on this podcast a few times. Nice guy, and normally pretty rational and pretty together. He's a pretty hard Brexiter himself, but he will engage with debate. And he's pointed out that loads of people on the Remain side claim we weren't that deeply embedded before the referendum. But now that we're trying to extricate ourselves and it's turning out to be difficult, Remainers are saying, oh, well, it took us 40 years to get in this deeply embedded. It's going to take us a while to get out. And that's the exact opposite of what they were saying before the referendum. And I take that point. And I'd probably take it on the chin. I'm not sure I personally ever said it, but there were definitely people on the Remain side who did say it. But the fact is, it has taken a very long time for us to get this deeply embedded. You know, there are agencies that we have and we use that simply didn't exist when we were an independent country before we went into the EEC. And the idea that we can just click our fingers and create all these hundreds and hundreds of bodies that need to exist to measure this and assess that and be able to facilitate this, that and the other is just for the birds. It's like, of course it's going to take a long time. And also it's going to cost a lot of money. And it's going to use up so much resource. I mean, hardly anything else is happening in Parliament at the moment.
I know. That's the most depressing thing.
Yeah, it's crazy. And like, this is completely self-inflicted, and it's going to go on for years and years and years. And I think this is one of those situations where I was reading up about Athenian democracy the other day, because one of the things you hear people say is, well, it's right that everyone should have, you know, a say in referendums, and we should have more referendums, and, you know, and why shouldn't people be able to say what they think and input into the political process directly? And I mean, I think this referendum in particular, I think, was handled very, very badly in all sorts of ways that we've talked about before. You know, the Irish referendum on allowing abortion, I think, was a really good example. They had a kind of citizens jury that met beforehand, and they had a really, really involved public debate. They then published precisely what would happen in legislation before the referendum, so everyone knew exactly what would happen and what the safeguards would be, and had time to think it through. And then finally there was the vote, and the vote went the way that I would have wanted it to go. But even if it had gone the way I didn't want it to go, I still would have said it was a good process and it was a well done referendum. I'm not just looking at that in hindsight and saying, oh, that was good because we won, because our team won. It's not that. It's that it was a well done process. This was terrible because we had no idea what was going to happen if we voted leave. There were lies on both sides, but the lies were particularly bad on the leave side, where they just made stuff up and they did it deliberately. You know, Dominic Cummings is on record as saying that they picked that number, 350 million on the side of a bus, because they knew it was wrong, and they knew that the Remain side would start arguing about the number, and all that anyone would hear is, well, it's still many, many millions. That's still far too much money that we're sending, and it would just keep it focused on that number. So there were all sorts of political games that were being played through that. But the idea, so I said about Athenian democracy, the idea that people get to vote on everything all the time requires a highly informed citizenship, and that's what they had in Athens. A very, very highly informed populace. Well, and we don't have that
a small state as well. Also, you know, that sort of system can only work in a small grouping.
Exactly. But the thing is, we don't have that in this country. And I know that people who listen to this are going to be thinking, oh, who's this twat who's saying that I don't understand enough about politics? And it's like,
we haven't said hi to Emma yet, have we? Hi, Emma. Hope you're listening.
The truth is, yeah, Emma calls me a twat regularly.
She does.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm missing it.
But the point is that most people would hold their hands up and say, I don't really care very much about politics. I don't really know much about politics. I'm not really interested in it. It's true. Most people aren't interested. I remember I had a debate with a friend of mine who's nothing to do with politics. And I'm sure he won't be listening to this podcast because he's not interested in politics at all. I was having a debate with him over curry one night, and he was saying, we should have referendums all the time on everything. Like, why can't I just go and why can't we just vote on everything? And I said, well, the thing is, like, that's all well and good, but did you vote at the last general election? No. Okay. Did you vote in the local elections 3 months ago? No. Did you vote in the European elections 2 years ago? No. Did you vote in the AV referendum in 2011? No. I said, okay, you're saying you want a referendum every week on stuff. Okay, that's fine. You might vote the first two or three times because it's a novelty, but pretty soon you won't be voting regularly. Do you know who will be voting regularly? Me. I will go and vote in every single one because I've voted in every single election I was able to vote in. What you'd effectively be doing is giving me more power because me and people like me would vote in all of those referendums, and people like you probably wouldn't in the end because you get tired of it and you're just not that interested in it in the end. So the reason we have a representative democracy is so that you elect your representatives and they can take the time and effort to understand this stuff and then vote on your behalf. And that is the foundation of our democracy. And the reason why we're in such a constitutional crisis now is because we've completely short-circuited that process. And we've ended up in a position where MPs are trying to implement something that they don't believe in.
And I think this is the other really key point, which the Irish example was a very good example of saying how it should have been done. After the referendum happened, there was no one left to implement it, and because obviously Leave, as tactically, which was a very good move, and Macy made up a coalition of all the dissatisfied. If you were sort of a super socialist and you wanted to get leave the EU because you wanted to have complete control over nationalisation, public spending, or if you were an arch libertarian and wanted to get away from or arch neoliberal, get away from Brussels control, you voted Leave, even though what you wanted in life was absolutely a polar opposite of the political spectrum. But they could do that because there was no sort of clear implementation of what Leave would mean, which is all the mess we've got come to since then has been based all on that, really. So in a funny way, Parliament, I think, probably reflects the reality right now at the moment. Remain is in the majority, Leave is in the majority, but no one knows how to do it. So there's no majority of how to leave. So we're stuck in this sort of limbo land at the moment.
Yes. And we'll be talking about this probably forever. Okay, well, probably leave that for now, and I'm sure we'll pick this subject up again.
Mark, you haven't asked. You said we're going to ask each other what our favourite conspiracy theory was.
Oh yeah, I'd forgotten about that.
So, do you have a favourite conspiracy theory?
I'm not sure favourite is the right one. I was at a thing back in 2009, I think it was. It was called the Convention on Modern Liberty. It was held in some hotel in London, and I wandered outside to go and get a drink or something. And there were a load of people protesting outside, holding up pictures of the World Trade Center on fire with question marks and circles drawn around planes and stuff. And I said, "What's going on here?" And some woman said, We're here to tell you the truth about what happened on 9/11. And she started ranting on about explosions being planted and buildings collapsing vertically. And why did the third building collapse when no plane even flew into it? And how come a local news broadcast journalist knew that the building was going to collapse because they'd announced it had collapsed before it had collapsed? So the cat was out of the bag there, and they'd let the news out early rather than after it had actually happened. And I'm just standing there thinking, you're a grown woman. Why are you just believing this nonsense? And it was in her eyes. She was so fervent. It's like there was no question that she absolutely believed this stuff. So I'm not sure I would describe it as my favorite, but it was definitely a kind of watershed moment in my understanding of my relationship with conspiracy theorists. Because, sometimes you see stuff written down and you think maybe someone's doing this for shits and giggles. She was absolutely adamant. There was no question that she definitely believed this stuff. And it made me realize just how deep this stuff goes. It's almost like a religion. It's like, someone who gets indoctrinated into a cult. It's the same kind of thought processes, I think. And I think that's what makes it so scary.
Oh, I mean, for me, it has to be the lizards. the fact that the royal family are reptiles, and they're joined with other reptiles running the world and aliens. I think that's I think that's the most amazing of the conspiracy theories.
I think where did that come from?
I mean, I know it came from David Icke.
Well, I think David Icke's actually doing a tour at the moment. I'm sure I saw some dates, so maybe we'll post a link to that. Maybe Emma can post a link to David Icke's tour dates on the Twitter feed.
Obviously there's group of humans who run the world in or whatever, fair enough, but the fact that they're aliens, and as if an alien group of aliens would come down to Earth and set up a constitutional monarchy.
Well, you're probably
as
too
a system,
young.
I mean, if they really were really that powerful and interested in controlling all of us, I mean,
you're probably too young to remember, because how old were you in 1984?
I would have been four.
Right. So you'd be too young to remember. There was a TV series called V, which was very, very instrumental. Culturally important to me in my young life. I was exactly 10 years old. It was on my 10th birthday when the first episode of that was broadcast on ITV, and it was broadcast every night for a week. And it was all about lizards coming down from outer space and taking over the world. And I do wonder if David Icke watched that programme and something in his brain just snapped. At that point, he was still a sports commentator for the BBC, and he was a former goalkeeper. But I just wonder if that was the seed that was planted, and maybe NBC and Kenneth Johnson have a lot to answer for. There are about four TV geeks who'll get that reference, and everyone else will just be scratching their heads thinking, what's he on about now? This is new obsession. Is he giving up on electoral reform? Okay. And on that bombshell, I think we'll wrap it up. So thanks very much for your time tonight, Nick.
I've enjoyed it.
Good, I have too. And I'd like to thank Kevin MacLeod at incomputech.com for our theme music. And this has been a Political Human production.